Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. In this podcast, DJ Nordquist, formerly of the World Bank Group and White House Council of Economic Advisors, talks with Darden Professor Dan Murphy about how government can effectively support a free market economy.
I'm thrilled that DJ is here to talk to us. Thank you very much, DJ, for this conversation.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
All right. So I thought maybe we'd start by just talking about your most recent experience at the World Bank. And my somewhat naive perspective of the World Bank is their objective is to reduce global poverty. When you were there, how did you see their objectives and what did you try to do to help them? Like, where did you see that they were doing their objectives well? And where did you see where you need to step in and say, hey, let's do this a little bit better? Like, what were some of your experiences at the World Bank?
So I would say that, yes, the mission is to eradicate extreme global poverty. And that's a mission that's actually changed over time. You know, the World Bank was formed, it was, you know, Bretton Woods back in 45, I believe. I think it was really founded in response to World War II and rebuilding Europe's economy. Fun fact, the first loan, or at banks they call them projects, was to France. And it was quite controversial because the bank put stipulations, or conditionality as the bank calls it, on the loan, which was in order to get, I think it was $250 million, but don't quote me on that. the French government had to purge the Communist Party from its government. So that's sort of the beginning of conditionality at the World Bank. I can't imagine that the bank would do that today because the bank is supposed to be apolitical. I think as time has gone on, there's been, I'd call it a little bit of mission creep. You know, the bank does so many different things that in a sense, it's really not, it has lost a little bit of its focus on eradicating extreme poverty. And most people don't know it's the World Bank Group. There are actually five different parts of the World Bank. When you talk about the bank, it's mainly IBRD, which is the original part of the bank, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And then you have IDA, which is the International Development Association. And so the difference between IBRD and IDA is IBRD are mainly middle-income countries, mix. And the IDA countries are low-income countries, and so they get grants as opposed to loans. And then you have the private sector part of the bank called IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which has a different remit, which is basically to seed private capital in developing economies. And the idea is that if you seed some private sector, that eventually you will get more private sector coming in. And then there are two other parts of the bank, ICSID, which is dispute resolution, and then sort of a evaluation part of the bank as well.
So to the extent that they're doing these loans or seeding capital for development projects, should we think of these as subsidies to low-income countries, or are these projects that we're hoping will provide us with an economic return? I assume some are sort of, these are projects that, you know, we think we need a water treatment facility and no one else is going to pay for it, so we're going to pay for it. Are some of these other things like roads and other infrastructure that will have some sort of return that we're going to benefit from?
Yes. I mean, that's obviously the hope. Infrastructure, that would mainly be the IBRD or IDA part of the bank, where these are extremely low interest loans. And by the way, these loans always get paid back because it impacts, credit ratings and all that stuff. Countries, the clients, try to figure out what their needs are. And so they will work, it's an iterative process with the bank where they will say, I'll give you an example, Maldives, we want this $3 billion bridge to connect these two islands. And the bank will look at it and go, maybe that doesn't make the greatest economic sense. We will work with you on this other thing. And this can take like 2 to 3 years to sort of figure out what the project is and to get the funding and to get the board to approve it. But I'll explain like where the bank came in the Maldives, which was very interesting, is because of climate change, the government's been very focused on, they have, like I said, I think hundreds, thousands of islands. They're trying to move their population off of the outer islands into the capital. Because of climate change.
Is making it uninhabitable in the outer islands.
It's sort of like they're not, they're just gonna try to send, and so the bank has been working with them on this. But from a sort of development perspective, I would say, crowding people into, you know, one capital island, Malé, and et cetera, like you're actually, in a sense, concentrating a lot of poverty, which is against what most economic literature tells us, which is you should try to dissipate poverty. But that's one of the projects that the bank is working on there.
Sounds like there are these competing challenges, both between the climate change and what that's doing,
yes,
and people's ability to even, you know, sort of dissipate or
right.
Or
and then,
live in
interestingly,
areas.
The IFC side of the bank, which was a project that we visited when we were there, it's I think the eighth or ninth time that they've given this project to capital infusion in the farthest, the northernmost island in the Maldives, which is about an hour and a half flight from the capital, it's I believe it's a Shangri-La hotel. I could be wrong. I might not be remembering, but it's a luxury hotel chain, and the bank has given them, you know, eight different infusions of money, and this hotel is not going to make it. And so we met actually with the people. We met at that hotel, and we met with other hoteliers in that area who were like, "You're killing me because you guys are subsidizing this very, very expensive hotel, and we're not getting any of that money." But it didn't make sense because the government had this policy to try to get people off of the outer islands, and yet at the same time, IFC was pushing, you know, tourism, which actually is good economic, you know, development. But if you have tourism, then you need people to work at those hotels. And so you're not actually pulling people off of the outer islands.
So it sounded not as coordinated either as it could have been.
Right.
But let's just take the hotel example on face value. It sounds like part of that was economic development. Like, we want to build this hotel, hopefully people will come there. Why is it that the World Bank felt that they needed to even do the hotel in the first place? If it's going to be profitable, the private sector presumably might have done it on its own. So how does the World Bank decide when they need to step in versus when the private sector could otherwise do it?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay.
That's a question that I asked. I mean, particularly the Shangri-La Hotels, which is a big, you know, chain out of Hong Kong, fully liquid. They really didn't need this capital infusion. And in fact, one of my questions was, you know, at what point, first, second, third, fourth, we're now at the eighth loan, when are we going to stop and say that this is not a viable economic development?
So you said that China has kind of stepped in terms of funding different development projects, either where the World Bank hasn't or where the United States hasn't. And there's a question I've always had in my mind, and I'm hoping maybe you can help me think about it a little bit, and it's the following. If we think about how China's economy grew, they developed a huge export base based on a huge labor force, relatively low wages, so they could build stuff relatively low cost and export it to the world. Now it's more, you know, Chinese wages are higher, but there are other countries that still have very low wages, big labor force that could otherwise be a big export base. And you could think about places in Africa, maybe somewhere like Ethiopia. And so one question I have is, why is it that we don't see more manufacturing plants being built, capital flowing to Ethiopia or places like Ethiopia? And one explanation that economists tend to turn to is, well, Ethiopia, you know, institutions aren't quite as good, property rights aren't quite as established or something like that, so it's not as productive as you might think. And so there might be that explanation. And I'm wondering what you think about this alternative explanation, which is that if I want to build an exporting plant, a manufacturing plant, I also have to build a road. I have to build a port. I have to build a whole electricity infrastructure. So for me to actually be able to build something there, I have to do a massive capital infusion. It might be expected to be profitable, but there's huge risk. And so what that means is you have to pool a ton of capital, and maybe our private sector just isn't coordinated enough to send that big of an infusion of capital, even if it's going to be profitable. And so one view of what China's doing, so take the Belt and Road Initiative, you could think about them as their government is able to just overcome that coordination failure and direct all of this capital into, say, African countries or all over the world into developing countries. How much of what you see in the Belt and Road Initiative is that? It's sort of like there are these positive economic returns, and because China can just allocate the capital, they can overcome this coordination failure versus geopolitical stuff. You know, it's like not necessarily economically beneficial or going to have a positive return, but it's for their own geopolitical ends.
Very good question. I'm not sure anybody knows the answer except for people inside the PRC. And by the way, I haven't worked at the bank in a year, so I forgot one part of the bank that you raised, which is MIGA, which is Mutual Insurance Guarantee Association. So that is political risk insurance. And so, you know, American or foreign firms can actually buy political risk insurance, which gives them the sort of security to go into some of these developing markets and have, you know, some assurance that they're not going to lose their shirts. And, you know, I would say the United States, and one of my jobs at the World Bank was I would try to advocate for U.S. firms to actually win bank procurement, or even just to compete for bank procurement. And much to my chagrin, about, depending on how you count, 30 to 40% of World Bank procurement goes to Chinese firms, which are mainly SOEs, state-owned enterprises. So it's very unfair competition. The government subsidizes these firms. Can you guess what percent the U.S. wins of World Bank procurement?
I could try, but I would fail, so.
It's 1%.
Okay, I was going to guess more than that, but okay.
And that includes actually UN agencies, because the bank will, you know, contract with the UN. So it's really not very much money. We're the world's, you know, we're the bank's largest shareholder. This is, I took my job as sort of a fiduciary for U.S. taxpayer dollars very seriously. And in terms of like bang for the taxpayer dollar, we're not really getting it from the World Bank. And so I asked a number of American firms, like, why are you not competing? And part of it is they don't have to, because we've got, you know, strong domestic market. And second, the size of these projects is not like big enough for like a Bechtel or AECOM or those companies. And third, they know they won't win because China will underbid most other companies that try to compete.
And so was your view that we should have paid more and brought more American companies in, been willing to pay more and spend more through the World Bank?
I don't think it would have made a difference.
Okay.
And I mean, there have been reforms to the procurement system where it's not necessarily lowest cost bidder, but and I'd have to go back and look at the data since the reforms were put in and what's going on today. I didn't see a huge difference from when they initially put those reforms in. But getting back to your question about China and you know, BRI or OBOR or whatever you want to call it, Belt and Road Initiative. So I don't think China is going into these countries necessarily for. A lot of times these projects don't make any economic sense. I mean, right. It's really, they talk about sort of a nascent, you know, it is the 21st century version of the Silk Road, where they want to create these trading routes and create countries that are actually dependent on China. And, you know, a lot of these loans are, the debt is just completely unsustainable. The countries don't understand the covenants that they're entering into. I mean, the bank, you know, is some, you know, small basis, you know, BIPs above LIBOR or whatever, SOFR or whatever the interest rate turns into. Whereas, you know, so we're talking about like 1.5-2% maybe, and China's loaning at like 8%. So it's a great deal. And China, by the way, still takes money from the World Bank, even though, in my opinion and many others, it is a developed country. But they are still taking loans from the World Bank, at pretty good rates, and then, you know, they're turning around and loaning it out
at 8%. At a much higher rate. Interesting.
So who wouldn't do that, right?
Yeah.
And you know, like the famous cases, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, Hambantota port in Sri Lanka. Where, you know, China went in and built this port and Sri Lanka defaulted on the debt, and then China seized the port. And so, you know, I think there's a part of China, like maybe the Ministry of Finance, that actually wants to collect on these loans. And then I would say probably more on the national security military side. I think they're probably hoping that these loans go into default and they can seize the asset. In fact, a couple of months ago, the airport in Entebbe went into default and China was going to seize it, and there was international outrage. And so I think they haven't seized it yet, but I'm not sure if they're working out the debt.
So this whole conversation makes me think about, like, how do you optimally procure, like, who should we spend our money toward? How do we spend it? And if we turn away just from the World Bank and think domestically about like what our top priorities are. So, you know, if I'm sitting at home and I hear all kinds of stuff on the news about what we're doing, what we're not doing, whether it's good or what it's bad, if we were to just kind of distill it, what do you think our top priorities should be? Like, what should our government be spending on, and conditional on them spending on that? Like, how should we make sure that it's efficient and effective?
Well, I think given that Ukraine is on everybody's mind right now, I think unfortunately we're probably going to have to start spending up again on defense.
Okay.
I think that's just, and I mean, I know like our NATO allies, you know, they're supposed to be spending 2% of their budgets on defense. They have not. I will say Vladimir Putin amazingly got the, within a week, the Germans overturned 40 years of, you know, Ostpolitik, and is suddenly going to put in their 2% to NATO of their budget. They've you know, figured out that they should not be dependent on Russia for natural gas. You know, Putin also within 1 week made, you know, Sweden and Switzerland no longer neutral, and managed to get American politicians to call somebody else Hitler instead of each other.
Yeah, I guess if we're going to look for the bright side, I guess the silver lining of a very challenging situation. That's a good perspective to have, I suppose.
So yeah, I mean, and you and I had this conversation earlier. Like, I actually think defense spending, sure, there's a lot of waste. There's whatever the $650,000 toilet seat example that everybody remembers from a few years ago.
I didn't know that, actually.
Oh yeah, that was like a famous example that because of, you know, U.S. procurement practices and subcontractors and subs to the subs to the subs, there was, I can't even remember, it was like literally a $650,000 toilet seat that the Pentagon had procured.
I hope it's nice. Okay.
It better be gold. but, you know, I think, you know, generally speaking, and I know you have a paper on it that I just skimmed, you know, I think defense spending is actually pretty stimulative. It's pretty good for the local economy. And actually, going back to the World Bank question, there was a good paper that I cited quite a bit when I was at the bank and in my confirmation hearing, which actually found that World Bank projects had pretty good, you know, return on development projects in, you know, when they went into these foreign countries, and the paper compared it to Chinese bilateral aid and found that the Chinese bilateral aid had zero development impact and actually had a negative impact in terms of corruption. So, like, the Chinese would come in and the corruption would spread around the entire area, which is very interesting. And I mean, one thing that actually we didn't touch on the Chinese question is, you know, I think when an American contractor goes in, chances are they are going to hire some local labor, which is a good development outcome. When a Chinese SOE goes into a lot of these areas, they bring Chinese workers in. Mm. And so you don't actually have any labor market stimulation or anything like that.
Interesting.
And you have huge cultural problems when you bring in another nationality to do the labor. There was actually a famous case at the World Bank in Uganda where they were building a road, and I can't remember who the Chinese contractor was, but they brought in Chinese workers, and there was just a tremendous, I don't know what the right word is, tremendous increase in rapes. The Chinese workers were raping a lot of the local girls. It was happening basically under the bank's nose. The bank realized that they had to redo their systems to have a better reporting system. But it was, you know, obviously the last thing you want if you're coming in as a World Bank project is to end up having local women and girls being raped from a project.
So it sounds like, yeah, and I think about a $650,000 toilet, and then I'm thinking about these, and I'm like, oh, maybe like, you know, government, you know, we should have no interventions anywhere or something like that. But surely that's not the answer, as you said, like. Defense would be like the classic example of a public good. Like, you know, it's like if we were left to our own devices, we're all running around with our own military defense systems or something. It doesn't work. Like, we want the government to do that for us. And so, as you said, maybe that's something that will become more of a priority. What else? If we think about the biggest challenges facing the world, and I know the war in Ukraine looms large, what else out there do you see as some of the biggest challenges? And what do you see as the roles of the public or private sector in like constructively addressing? Like, clearly we don't want another $650,000 toilet, but like maybe that's an example, but where can we like constructively come
up
with
solutions?
So I mean,
another important role for federal, state, local governments is obviously infrastructure. We had a huge infrastructure bill that finally passed. It was amazing to me that like how hard it was to get an infrastructure bill through. That should be a bipartisan issue. I mean, our infrastructure spending is sort of by formula, which is not necessarily the way that you want to do it, but that's...
And what do you mean by that when you say it's by formula?
By formula. So it's just there's like a set amount that each state gets based on,
population
various issues. But because, you know, we are a democracy with 535 different members of Congress, you get, you know, there's some low population states that get, you know, maybe more infrastructure spending than, you know, like a large metropolitan city. But those large metropolitan cities are getting mass transit, which, you know, rural America is not getting. So, and I mean, but interestingly, actually, there are a lot of these public-private partnerships in the infrastructure space, and you do have some private companies that are building, like I think the toll road out here was a private company, and it's, you know, surge pricing and that kind of stuff, which, I mean, I think surge pricing is, I mean, you're an economist, that's a brilliant idea, right? I mean, you should be should pay more when it's more congested, and then hopefully that will reduce the congestion.
Yeah. So it sounds like infrastructure is something that, like, we want more of, we need more of. How do we go about, so it sounds like, but there are all these other challenges where if we make it more democratic, if states get to decide who gets what, or they, you know, then it becomes a little bit less efficient. Maybe Wyoming gets like a million roads and there aren't that many people in Wyoming or something like that. Do you have a vision for how to make that more efficient? Is there a way, you know, I think about like central banking. You know, we have said, okay, our central bank is going to decide the money supply. We don't get everyone from the states together and debate about it or whatever else. It's like we're going to give one institution. We've already democratically like given up the money supply to this institution that I think a lot of people trust, hopefully still.
And maybe, maybe a little less right now.
Well, yeah.
They took away the punch bowl just maybe a little bit late.
But it's a hard job. It's a hard job, right? So this is the thing, like, you know, we can always quibble with any policy. Or tell me if you think this is a fair analogy for the government more generally. Imagine a family trying to get together for a vacation. And the objective is you want to spend time together as a family. There are things that you want to do together and it makes everyone better off. But like everyone has different preferences for what sort of food they want to eat or where they want to do a vacation or whatever else. And so we all have to decide, like, as a family, we're going to put in on this. We're not going to love everything, but we're willing to give up a little bit so that we actually have this sort of family unit. And is it fair to think about government and policy in the same way? It's sort of like we want the government to do certain things, defense and infrastructure too that we've mentioned. I might not get the exact roads I want. I might not get the exact monetary policy I want. Sometimes they're going to make a mistake. Sometimes my brother's going to make the worst dinner at a family, you know, whatever, and it's going to be miserable. We'll have totally screwed it up. It was totally forecastable, and yet that's still going to happen. You know, we'll get that in the government too. But how do we design a system where we allow for a little bit of that? We recognize that there are some challenges, but we still ensure that the institutions do the things we really need it to do. Are we already doing that, or are there more things that we can do, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at polling, I think people want the government to do a certain number of things until you ask them if they want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, well, I don't want to pay for it. I want the guy who made the dinner to pay for it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or it's like on the family vacation, yeah, I want to show up, but I might not want to pay for it or something
right.
like that.
So I think that's also the beauty of a democracy, right? I think it's a really tough question. I mean, I think Americans have lost a lot of faith in our institutions in probably the last 10 to 20 years. I worked on Hurricane Katrina recovery back in 2005. And I read a really interesting book called Rising Tide, which talked about like the history of floods in New Orleans going all the way back to the 1800s. And it was very interesting to me because, and a lot of people don't know this, Herbert Hoover was actually the Secretary of Commerce before he became president. Herbert Hoover invented the press release. He got his people to start sending out press releases saying how great a job the Department of Commerce was doing. But I mean, if you look back to like the local, you know, the people in Missouri, I mean, Mississippi and Louisiana back then, even the state and local governments did not want any help from the federal government and not even the Red Cross. I mean, they refused help from the Red Cross. They said, this is bad, we're gonna fix it ourselves. Which is obviously very different than what you see today, where when you have obviously like a huge hurricane or an earthquake or a natural disaster, everybody was like, where's the federal government? Are they going to help me? So
that mean that there's more faith or less faith in our institutions? I could see that as there's more faith in our institutions. We want the federal government here to help us. Or?
Well, I mean, like Katrina, I think was an example of, I mean, there were multiple failures at the government level, at the state, local, and federal level. And it took 50 years to sort of build up all the problems in New Orleans Hurricane Katrina, the flood was a man-made disaster. That was a failure of the levees. It was a Category 2 storm by the time it hit New Orleans. And part of that was, you know, there was evidence that a lot of the locals, instead of using the money for levee maintenance, they were building swimming pools on the levees, and then I think, you know, the locals also weren't maintaining the sewer systems and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you also have the federal government is at fault for a lot of that because of NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, which is really interesting. We have obviously a lot of people who live in coastal areas, you know, near flood-prone zones, and in the 1960s, private insurers said, you know, this is actually really, we're losing a lot of money here. We're not going to insure anybody anymore, which should have been a signal that people should live there. And instead, the federal government came in and said, well, we'll just create a national flood insurance program. And so now, you know, taxpayers are subsidizing people to live in these areas that are not particularly safe. And, you know, the federal government went in and built these huge highways that went right down into the lower ninth. And so that's where people lived, even though it's 30 feet below sea level.
Do you get a sense that instances like that, where maybe the federal government has subsidized something they clearly shouldn't, or politics intervened, you know, there were too many political factors that made policy very suboptimal, then gets in the way that it makes people say, look, we don't want government at all, and yet sometimes we need the government? Like, think about defense spending, you know, as you said, like, we probably need it more than ever now. We could come up with examples where the Department of Defense is messed up. I imagine. I don't have any on the top of my mind, but there are probably a few. That doesn't mean that I assume that we get rid of defense spending, right? And so it seems to me that we're pretty oriented toward how do we make defense good? How do we make it do what we want to do? And yes, there are some mistakes. In other areas of the government, is there a way to orient ourselves toward that? Or should we just say, look, they've kind of screwed up, let's leave everything to the private sector?
I mean, obviously there's a need for government. I mean, sort of when you talk about government failures or people's dependence on government. So going back to the Katrina example, we had to make a decision about what percent of the levees we were going to build back, because I think it was 400 miles or something of levees. It's a huge levee system. And basically, we could do 98% for the same price as doing the last 2%. And that last 2% was in Plaquemines Parish, which is like way down, and it's where a lot of like oil workers live, et cetera, et cetera. And so we had to make this very tough decision to say, like, we just don't think it's worth taxpayer dollars to go ahead and redo the levees down there. And the people who live down there were like, we don't care, we're gonna stay here. And, you know, the government has, you know, rules and regulations that are like, basically, okay, if you're gonna stay there, you've gotta build your house up on 25-foot stilts. And some did and some didn't, and they were like, we don't care, we're just on our own. But I mean, that's, you know, I think that's an extreme example. I do think the government obviously has, you know, provides very good services for a lot of the things that we do. I mean, we're animals, we need, you know, sort of an organizing entity,
yeah.
Otherwise there's chaos. In an ideal world, government is improving the lives of people. And, you know, for the most part, it does. There are examples when it doesn't and when it makes mistakes. And I mean, one of the things I used to say at the World Bank was the World Bank is not a perfect entity. No organization is a perfect entity. And if we make a mistake, we need to admit that we made a mistake.
Yeah.
And that was, as a organization, I thought it was very hard for people at the World Bank to actually admit that mistakes had been made.
And I wonder, do you get the sense that part of that might be because once you admit a mistake, you know, the political machinery goes into action and then all of a sudden uses that admission as a reason to cut funding and strip things away. And so maybe we need some sort of a system that says that more incentivizes people to acknowledge mistakes, learn from them and do better.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously we have like a highly litigious society as well. So, yeah, but I mean, like, when's the last time you heard a politician admit that they made a mistake? And so that's not just unique to the World Bank. I mean, that's
human nature, maybe, or something anyway. Yeah,
human
yeah.
nature. But I think Americans, I think we're okay with people making mistakes. Like, we forgive a lot of people. Like, think about all the stupid celebrities that made mistakes that are doing just fine now, right? Like, like, if you admit a mistake and then move on, and I think people are forgiving. You know, government's a little bit different because it's like everybody thinks they're spending a lot of their taxpayer dollars on this, and why is the government doing XYZ? But I mean, people obviously get a lot of benefits from government too. I mean, when you think about like Social Security, it's the most successful government program at eliminating elderly poverty.
Yeah.
So I mean, there are some good examples like that.
And if I understand correctly, you're involved in some initiatives in terms of clean energy. Is that right? What do you see as the problem and the solution based on your experience there? And I know that's a big, broad question. But I'm curious, like, is a carbon tax efficient? Will that do what we need to do? Or, you know, is your, to the extent that you're involved in this, are you saying, look, we need to tax carbon, or is it we need to do other things? Is it private sector, public sector? How do we tackle that big social issue?
So, you know, the sort of econ background person in me loves the carbon tax. It's a very efficient tax. You're taxing something that you want less of. I would also posit that right now we are living through a carbon tax.
Yeah, no, that's
and people are pissed. So
it's a very rapid, you know, it's an abrupt.
I mean, you know, I think climate change is a serious issue. You know, I often cite this paper by Joe Aldi, who's an economist at Harvard, where he talked about like sort of the three prongs of climate change, which was adaptation, mitigation, and innovation. And you know, our policymakers have really, really focused on sort of adaptation, which I sort of jokingly call the hair shirt theory, which is we're all gonna, you know, stop plugging in our phones, and we're gonna go green tomorrow, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's basically no political will to do that in this country, let alone, I mean, this is, you know, in terms of the environment as a global public good, which is what the World Bank and the UN agencies call it. I mean, what is happening in China? I mean, China emits more greenhouse gas emissions than the US and the EU and Australia and Japan combined. So we can sit here and keep wearing the hair shirt, but China is continuing to build coal plants, not just in China, but other places in Asia and in Africa, and doing those loans at very high interest rates. And so they're gonna continue to spew. They talk about how they wanna be green. And by the way, they do manufacture the vast majority of the world's solar, you know, polysilicate, because they see green, and it's not the same kind of green that we're hoping for. They see money. You know, I think so anyway, going back to paper, you know, like I really think we need to focus on innovation. I think the innovation piece is so important. I think, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. I really feel like that is one of the only ways that we're gonna sort of fix this climate issue, is we're gonna have to innovate the heck out of it. And I have a lot of hope. There are a lot of really great new technologies out there. There's, you know, carbon capture, underground storage, there's direct air capture, nuclear. I'm a huge fan of nuclear. It doesn't get any, you know, greener than nuclear. And I mean, Germany, I think, is a really good example of how not to transition correctly. And there has to be a transition. We're not gonna be able to go green tomorrow. And the technology isn't there yet. And you know, the example I use is like one Tesla battery, depending on how you calculate it, can take about 200,000 pounds of dirt, of minerals, to make one Tesla battery. So, you know, I really think it's not gonna happen instantaneously. It's also very expensive. Not everybody can afford a Tesla. I was talking about Germany. I mean, Germany decided, you know, okay, they're done after Fukushima. They're like, we're done with nuclear and we're done with coal. And so they did ramp up their green, but at the same time they were importing, I can't remember what the percentage is, a large amount of their natural gas from Russia. which, you know, and they were also, by the way, still importing a lot of coal power from Poland, but because it was generated in Poland, it didn't count against their NDCs, and so it didn't count against their carbon emissions, which is not exactly honest. So, you know, unfortunately, they learned the hard way and by the way, the United States for many, many years, going back to Ronald Reagan, actually said, like, why are you guys importing all this, you know, gas from Russia? And, you know, I know the United States many times said to them, like, we've got all this LNG. We would love to ship it to you. Can you build some terminals? And there was an agreement to build those terminals, and then Merkel, you know, ended the contract.
It sounds like international cooperation on this is incredibly important, but also incredibly challenging, is what I'm taking away. But I did want to ask, do you think that it's sufficient to have, like, if we impose a high enough carbon tax, will that innovation come from the private sector? Or is there a role for the government to subsidize R&D above and beyond, say, just a carbon tax?
Well, so it is subsidizing a lot of R&D.
Okay. Should it be, I guess, might
Yeah.
be.
I mean, there's a lot of private sector, private sector is doing a lot, obviously. There's a lot of social pressure on companies to do ESG, and, you know, a lot of companies are stopping investing in, you know, brown energy, et cetera, et cetera. So I definitely think the private sector is looking for answers. There are permitting issues with a lot of this stuff, like particularly long-term battery storage. Like I know somebody who works at a company and they've been waiting 8 years to get their permit to start mining in Idaho. The infrastructure bill has $30 billion for green energy R&D projects. And so that's a lot of wampum. There's gonna be a new office in the Department of Energy that's gonna oversee all that. And they have to hire 1,000 people to oversee. And if you look at the chart of like sort of money at DOE, you know, going for green energy, it's sort of like, and then the infrastructure is like up like that. So, I mean, it's a lot of money, you know, sort of a good government doobie. I'm a little worried about the government oversight. And so I hope that DOE can staff up and find 1,000 people that actually know this space and want to work for the federal government. So we got to keep our fingers crossed, but there's going to be a lot of grants going out. $30 billion is a lot of money.
Thank you, DJ, for all of your time.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.